ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Politics Professor Quentin Berriford's examination of the Australian gambling industry began, as he puts it, with an epiphany of sorts. A few years ago, at home, he set up a TV and comfy chairs in his study so he could share, like a lot of grandparents would like, his grandson's first AFL game experience with him. And what followed was some degree of shock because he realised just how many gambling advertisements he was exposing his grandson's young mind to. So in the following week, he called the AFL and their administrators to ask why such an onslaught was permitted. And he got the usual spiel about funding to grow the game and the like. Quentin then began to dig further into the size and scope and history of big gambling in Australia. He directed his focus to a book called Hooked, Inside the Murky World of Australia's Gambling Industry, where he looks at the dark side of the industry, the normalisation of gambling through saturation advertising, the growth of problem gambling, the fact that governments know about the problems full well, but don't do much, if anything, about it. He joins us this evening. Quentin, good evening to you, and welcome to Nightlife.
G'day, Phil. Thanks for having me on.
Let's take that. Let's go back to that moment. Whether you remember what game you're watching, do you?
Well, it'd be a game involving Essendon because that's my team. And look, yes, it was quite a profound moment for me. Partly, I think, because I was I'm a grandparent rather than a parent.
Yeah.
And I know my grandson's parents aren't sport watching people on TV, so I felt this kind of burden of responsibility.
To introduce the boy to some of the roles of modern life, yeah.
Yeah. And I felt the burden of responsibility, not only around introducing him to football, but the onslaught of gambling ads. And he was looking at me quizzically like, you know, Grandpa, what's going on here? And I just didn't have an adequate explanation for why families with children watching football should be exposed to, you know, the depiction of dumb blokes, you know, having a lot of, you know, roly-poly fun with gambling. I just had no answer to it. And so you could see what was happening. You could see, you know, it took you 5 seconds to work out what was going on here. And it was my first encounter.
Well, you hadn't seen these things before?
Look, this experience goes back a decade when this happened. And I hadn't realised that a High Court decision had come down, which paved the way for online gambling companies to operate across the country. And with that came the pretty quick onslaught of gambling ads. And I had known that. And if I'd seen gambling ads before that time with my grandson, I hadn't been aware of it. So it was kind of a shock.
Tell me about that High Court decision.
Well, the High Court decision was 2008 when West Australia, another Western Australian sensible decision, tried to keep online gambling companies out of operating in Western Australia. And Betfair, your listeners probably heard of Betfair, one of the big gambling companies, took the state to court and won. In other words, the Constitution says you can't restrict trade across the states. And that led to the proliferation of online gambling across the nation and with it, advertising across the nation. And that's what I encountered 2008 with my grandson. He's now a very capable, clever, delightful young 18-year-old. And it was the encounter with the AFL. It was their disconnect, their disinterest.
Yeah.
I spoke to, I asked to be directed to an executive. And
did you get one?
The person I was speaking to nominated himself as an executive. He sounded like one. He sounded pretty important. And I just thought the conversation lacked any consciousness about what they were doing. That is really exposing a younger generation to gambling culture, to gambling habits, and to the normalisation of gambling as a harmless form of entertainment. I mean, it can be that, of course.
Well, it can be that.
Absolutely.
It's a curious one, gambling, isn't it? Because it's not like smoking, for example, where everyone knows smoking is bad for you, right? No one thinks smoking is good for you, and yet some people choose to do it anyway. And okay, you know, you can't be accused of not having the information at your disposal to make a rational choice about this. Some people say, yeah, I do. I understand that. I understand it's bad for me, but I'm going to do it anyway. A bit the same with drinking, I suppose. That's in a bit more of a grey area, isn't it?
Yep.
Because I think a lot of people, health experts too, might say some level of moderate drinking is okay.
Yep.
And gambling, though, is a legal activity. And you might say, well, look, you know, yeah, it's only an entertainment. So what's the problem here?
Well, it's a tricky area, of course, and I'm not opposed to gambling, and my book's not directed at banning gambling. My book's directed at understanding the growth of it, the impacts it's having. And look, I think that it is a grey area, and gambling for many people, perhaps most people, can be a controlled form of entertainment. I don't have any quibble with that. But the problem is a line's been crossed.
Yeah.
In the way that the gambling industry has got out of control in Australia. And you mentioned those figures. In fact, if I could just briefly correct the figure, it's not 25 billion losses annually, it's 32
okay.
is the most recent figure. And so it's crossed this line where it's become harmful to too many people, and that's the problem. And so we have to grapple with why that's occurred, the dimensions of the problems that it's causing, and why the political system's so reluctant to deal with it.
Yes, Quentin Beresford's with us. He's a professor of politics. He's written the most interesting book called Hooked. He's not a wowser, we should say this, inside the murky world of Australia's gambling industry. And what he's interested in is the way that big business has got hold of what in many ways some people might think is a harmless activity, having a flutter, and turned it into an industrial monster, which is fleecing people of billions and billions of dollars. How did it start? Well, I mentioned those figures saying we are the most gambling-addicted country in the world, or we lose the most.
We have the highest per-head losses.
How do we get how is that possible when we look at countries like, I don't know, Asian countries, for example? Chinese people love gambling.
Yeah, the figures wouldn't include China because you probably can't get
any reasonable figures out of it.
Reasonable figures out of it. But look, the promotion of gambling in China is illegal. And that's the reason why Crown Casino got into trouble a few years ago, because it was openly promoting gambling and the Chinese government arrested all the Crown staff operating in China and threw them in jail. So the Chinese Communist government, for all its flaws, and there are many, takes gambling seriously. Look, you mentioned the word rouser, and if we want to look at how the industry grew in Australia, which a little bit of history is helpful. There was, and people have probably forgotten this history, between the late 19th century and really up until the 1950s, gambling on sport other than on horses and dogs was illegal.
Yeah.
And that's where the whole rouserism thing came from. You know, being a killjoy, stopping people having a flutter on, you know, whatever sport they like. So horses were legal for obvious reasons, because every country town and every city had a horse, had
a racetrack.
And of course, when greyhound racing was legalised in the 1920s, that got the nod too. But then, of course, what we had was a flourishing, quote unquote, illegal gambling ecosystem with SP bookmakers and, you know, illegal casinos and all the rest of it. So, again, the whole era of prohibition didn't work for obvious reasons. So the starting point to understanding how the industry evolved in Australia was the deregulation of poker machines, which hitherto, like everything else, had been rendered illegal. So the New South Wales Labor government, after the end of the Second World War, legalised a whole lot of not-for-profit clubs, you know, what became the Big Leagues clubs. You'd be familiar with those in Sydney, of course. The Big Leagues clubs, the big RSL clubs. And then they lobbied the government to have exclusive use of poker machines. So almost overnight, you got a new social dimension in the community, you know, of these massive clubs. They offered lots of entertainment. You know, they provided a lot of social activities for people, and still do.
Well, they still do. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, the clubs have played a very important role in lots of ways, because they provided, you know, entertainment, dining, leisure, recreational activities, and a very congenial environment for people in areas where there was nothing.
Totally. And if you think too, the reason why that was so important, pubs at the time, 6 o'clock closing.
That's right.
They were rough drinking dens where, you know, women were, you know, required to go out the back. You know,
ladies' lounge.
So there was no fraternising between the sexes. So, look, things had to change. And again, I think the clubs industry is a really interesting social history and the roles they've performed. But what happened is they got exclusive use of poker machines and they very quickly realised how profitable they would be and they just packed them. Mm. With poker machines. All of a sudden, out in the suburbs and out in country towns were these, you know, quite lethal machines.
Yeah, let's talk about pokies for a second. Roy from Narrumburn wants to join the conversation. G'day, Roy.
Yes, good evening. How are you?
Well, thanks.
That's good. I was just going back to your comment of the targeting of males in particular and the male masculinity and, you know, I think you made a comment about being a wowser if you weren't into betting with your mates and those sorts of things. We were having the conversation in our household this week. We're watching on a commercial television station's streaming service. Almost every advert that is thrown up is for one of the big betting online betting agencies. But the bit that really caught our attention was the music that plays in the background, and it's subliminal, is "I Need a Hero." And we were having a bit of a laugh of the...
Oh, that song, the Holding Out for a Hero, isn't it?
Yeah. The one from Footloose, I think it was, is where I know it from. But, yeah, I Need a Hero, and the messaging that was going over the top of this every ad break, bet with us, bet with us, bet with us. You can do all these different forms of betting, but in the background, there's very subliminal "I Need a Hero" playing the whole time. And it was just interesting marketing towards that male masculinity that you were talking about.
Yeah, no, exactly right. It's a good point, isn't it, Quentin? Because, you know, I was listening to some ads today. They have cleverly associated being a young man. That you can't be a proper young man, a manly young man, a manly young Australian man, unless, one, you've got friends, and two, you like gambling. Because gamble as a young man and to have friends as a young man means to gamble together. And this has got deep roots in the Australian psyche in a way, hasn't it?
It has. You know, look, this is very clever advertising, obviously. Yeah. Firstly, I think we've just got to acknowledge the scale of it. Yeah. So calculations are there are about 1 million gambling ads a year, right? And these have escalated, as I said, since the early 2000s. So the scale of it is enormous. Secondly, it's promoted around sport, where families are watching and therefore kids are watching. And the interesting thing is they firstly targeted young men. The ads targeted young men, as you say, with this leveraging off the cultural DNA around mateship.
Yeah.
I mean, the ads are silly to me, but, you know, they're
yeah, but they create a feeling that, you know, if you're with your mates, you know.
Yeah, you're having fun.
Yeah, you're having fun.
Mates share time together.
Come on, we're just having fun. You have a bet.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But what's interesting recently is the targeting of young males just got saturated and they've increasingly directed the ads to women. And if you look at I was only watching the other day on SBS, I was watching SBS with my wife and we were just inundated with gambling ads, same as your caller said on SBS. And it was interesting because there's a lead up to the Spring Carnival in Melbourne and the ads very carefully struck, cleverly depicted women now. And so this is a new targeted audience they're going after because they've saturated the market for young males. You know, they've got every message they ever need about gambling. And so this is just what I would consider to be the rapaciousness, the predatory nature of the gambling industry, that they've normalised gambling as this harmless entertainment industry on a scale that doesn't occur anywhere else in the world. I mean, if you want to think about it, the scale of it, the carefully crafted nature of the advertising is just a giant social experiment. It doesn't occur anywhere else in the world. And it's interesting when New York Times did an article, big feature article on Australia's gambling industry in 2024. And it said that Australia is a warning sign of what can happen if you let this industry mature till its full extent. And that's what we've done.
Well, they're going down that path. It was for a while. Well, for long.
Well, to be told by America we're doing something bad seems to be particularly egregious.
It was illegal to bet on sport in most states of America until not that long ago, but they've changed that now.
Well, the industry's global. Mm. The industry's global. The companies are international. And this is happening in Britain. It's happening all over the Anglo world, and I'm sure in other countries as well. So, yeah, it's a model being practiced everywhere, but we've developed it to its fullest extent in Australia.
Here's a thing that gambling's also successfully attached itself to the idea that without gambling, you can't have many of the things that you really love in life. Now, that could be sport. In New South Wales in particular, it could be clubs. Now, people in Western Australia, rest at peace here for a minute while we discuss this, because you don't have these things. But this is particularly to do with poker machines, which started out as a peculiarly New South Wales thing, didn't they? And the industry, which became a world-leading industry, centred in New South Wales, is the creation of almost one person, Len Ainsworth.
That's right. The industry, as I said, was... poker machine industry was first deregulated in New South Wales. They were illegal until they did that in New South Wales in the mid-1950s. Mm. And New South Wales remained the only state that had them. I mean, John Cain, people will remember the Labor Premier of Victoria, very popular until he, you know, fell apart in the financial crash of the late 80s. He openly said poker machines exploit the working class and have nothing to do with them and kept them out of Victoria. And you mentioned WA, Labor government in WA, followed by other governments, banned them in Western Australia in the community. And it was interesting that 1974, the Tonkin Labor government set up a commission of inquiry, and members of that inquiry came over to New South Wales and looked at the club scene and were in their own minds disturbed by the social consequences of poker machines. And from that visit and the other work that they did, they banned them in Western Australia. It's interesting that Western Australia
and they've successfully kept them out, they're in the casino, but nowhere else. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I lived in Western Australia for decades, and so you know, Western Australians are justifiably proud of this history, and so they should be, because poker machines are particularly damaging for many, many people, and they've kept them out, and good luck to them.
I know that the Whitlams, the band, had a hit song with Blow Up the Pokies, which was a protest thing. But actually, that actually did happen, didn't they? Early on, someone did try to blow up Len Ainsworth's poker machine factory, didn't they, by throwing some sticks of dynamite onto it?
Well, they did, because the mafia moved in. Yeah. You know, in the 50s, by the late 50s, the industry in New South Wales was just so profitable. Selling poker machines into these clubs was huge. And skimming off the profits was, you know, obviously ripe for gangsters. And they moved in. And it's interesting, the American mafia moved into Australia to get a slice of the action. And Australia's infamous Lenny McPherson, you know, our Mr. Big of crime in the 1950s, he was running rackets around skimming profits off. So, yeah, I mean, there's a kind of dangerous history to all this too. It's a criminal history. And I mean, it's well known, of course. It was well known as soon as Las Vegas got up and running that the mafia controlled Las Vegas for decades. And that was well known in Australia and was one of the reasons that, you know, there were official inquiries in the 80s in New South Wales and Victoria about whether we should have casinos, not poker machines, but casinos. And those inquiries basically come down and said, you shouldn't. And if you do, you know, make them small, make them discreet, because people understood that casinos and indeed poker machines, they're, you know, one level they're entertainment, another level they're ripe for criminal infiltration, and it's what's happened.
Yeah, I love Len Ainsworth. Apparently famously he said, you know, do you realise what's going on here with the danger of it all? And he said, well, you know, it can be, that's true. Some people have a problem, but, you know, I would advise people if they wanted to stand beside someone on a poker machine until they've lost everything and lost all their money, and then I advise them to get on that machine straight away.
They're chilling, isn't it?
Because on the completely false assumption that if someone's lost for a long period of time, the machine is about to pay out.
About to win. Well, that's, you know,
but of course it's
anyway.
Not, it's
well, some of these machines, you know, on the more expensive ones will pay out perhaps once in their lifetimes.
Yeah.
But look, it's interesting. Len's a fascinating character. I mean, last I was aware, he's still alive. He's probably 102. Mm. He's a classic entrepreneur. Before poker machines were even legalised in New South Wales, he saw the writing on the wall and saw the opportunities and developed a factory and started making machines that steadily made him an absolute fortune because his machines were the most quote-unquote sophisticated.
Yeah.
In other words, they had the highest level of intensity, the rest, which is what the industry calls a gambling addiction. In other words, his machines could attract more people to stay longer on the machines than any machines almost made anywhere in the world. And Len's machines sold all over the world and, became a billionaire. But
Forget Wi-Fi or the Hill's toy store or the black box for aircraft. The poker machine was essentially an Australian, or the perfection of the poker machine was essentially an Australian success story, wasn't it?
Yeah, they were. I mean, they originally developed out of the US and they came with that, that tag, that one-armed bandit.
Yeah.
You know, early on, and people knew exactly, the losing odds on these things. And, yeah, Len perfected them and continued to perfect them. I mean, Len's machines are highly sophisticated. It's understood that, teams of psychologists, are deployed to understand how to make these machines more attractive to more players to play for longer. And there's just really sad stories around all this, of course, which I'm sure many of your listeners would know. Not only Len saying, don't leave your poker machine if you've been there for a long time because you lose.
Because it's about to pay out.
It's about to pay out. People stay at these machines and literally urinate, Phil, because they get so addicted to the chance of winning, to the what's called the zone. When people literally don't know how much they've lost, they've done studies on this kind of stuff and the psychology of poker machine gamblers. And, there's a high proportion of poker machine gamblers, when they're asked at the end of a session how much they've won or lost, they just don't know.
Mm. Quentin Beresford's my guest. He's a professor of politics at the University of the Sunshine Coast. He's written a very interesting book called Hooked: Inside the Murky World of Australia's Gambling Industry. We're talking about the corporatisation, the juggernaut of gambling that's taken over Australia and made us the biggest per capita loss maker, that is you, the punter, in the world. How did we get to this place? I mentioned earlier, Quentin, that they've successfully hooked onto a couple of myths. One, the deep psyche of Australian mateship, and that comes through every Anzac Day when people get involved in two-up, which, ought to be fun and remembering mates and so on. But it reinforces the idea that deep in the Australian legend is the fact that we love to gamble. And they've successfully hooked onto that. The other one they've successfully hooked onto is the idea that instilled in people's heads is that without gambling, as I said before, we wouldn't have a lot of the good things. We wouldn't have clubs. We wouldn't have good sporting recreation. We wouldn't have football teams and so on. How true is that?
Very true, I think. Right from the deregulation of poker machines in New South Wales, the government sold that development, that opening up of poker machines to ordinary people in the community, by taxing the betting on poker machines and directing that revenue to the hospital fund.
Right.
Right. So there was a social good, inverted commas, attached to gambling right from the very beginning. And in fact, that's why state governments are so wedded to the gambling industry and why they're so disinclined to do too much about it, because they've become reliant on gambling taxes. So, you can mount a difficult argument, morally difficult argument, that from gambling taxes, state governments offer lots of services. They do, but the question, of course, is at what cost to the community?
It is true that in parts of Victoria, New South Wales, Queensland too, that the clubs and granted, some of them have grown far beyond their original purpose, but many of the community-based clubs wouldn't exist without poker machines either.
Look, that's again, that's true, and it just shows how complex this area is to regulate because, you know, as I said earlier, the history of this is that after the war, people wanted new forms of entertainment. They wanted to be able to socialise in more sophisticated ways, with both the sexes, you know, happily socialising together. Pubs couldn't do that, so clubs filled the vacuum. And yes, they got world-class entertainment attracted to these clubs because they had huge memberships. You know, the big leagues clubs in Sydney, as I'm sure you're aware, Phil, you know, they have memberships in the tens of thousands.
Mm.
And so you could offer massive, new, interesting, exciting forms of entertainment. It's not an either, gambling's not an either or argument. It's an argument about understanding the realities
and
dealing with the dark side.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's why it's so complicated in a way.
Yeah, it is.
To talk about it without being labelled a wowser or a naysayer.
Yeah.
Either way. Kartika from Hobart. Hi, Kartika, is it? Hello.
Hi, the line seems a little scrambled. Sorry.
That's all right. You're in Hobart. Well, you're in the state that introduced the first legal casino, Kartika.
Yeah. I wanted to ring about that and to say that the government did regulate to allow that.
Hmm.
And the other...
Hello?
Yes, sorry. I've got a double line or something.
Mm-hmm. Go on.
It was also the issue around the sporting clubs and their links to the gaming industry. And this is where there's the partnership leading into the children, the young people getting exposed to it through just, you know, tabs, apps online and all the rest of it. They can get sucked into it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree.
Look, Tasmania, she raises a good point, Phil. I've forgotten and I just didn't catch her name.
Kartika.
She raises a really good point. I grew up in Tasmania and I was well aware as a teenager the fraught debate about legalising the first casino. They had to go to a referendum.
That's right.
And even the referendum was a bit cooked in terms of the question they asked and so on. But they were so concerned about... infiltration of crime. They were so opposed to poker machines coming to Tasmania that the casino was set up with very tight regulations, as Katrina said, and it was well run for many years, and the poker machines were kept out as part of the original deal. But that changed over time and poker machines came into Tasmania in a really sleazy deal, and a monopoly on poker machines was given to Federal Hotels, run by the Farrell family. And again, this is where you get the dark side of the industry. All those poker machines mainly are located in lower socioeconomic suburbs.
Yeah.
And you get the social problems, you know, metastasizing in those communities. And, a very, very troubling situation. And Farrell, as a consequence of his monopoly, ends up on Australia's rich list with about $500 million in wealth.
Mm. Yeah. Going back to this other issue, though, this connection between social good and gambling, sporting clubs, a lot of sports say, well, we couldn't exist without it. I mean, even big industries like the AFL, for example, or the National Rugby League, openly chase and pursue this, don't they? I mean, perhaps the National Rugby League more so. They've staged the opening round of their competition in Las Vegas for the last few years as a means clearly to try and link the two, their own sport and a gambling market. Are they actually dependent on it or are they just trying to make themselves dependent on it?
Well, they're making themselves dependent on it and they are dependent on it in the two things coincide. And look, I explore this in the book. You know, it's a big part of the book is to look at how the gambling industry effectively conquered sport, such that sport now exists really to expand the gambling market. That's where we've landed.
Mm.
And, you know, look, I mean, as soon as poker machines were released into the community, and that's another phase of the way the industry grew. So you got poker machines in clubs in New South Wales, then you got your first casinos in Hobart and Crown Casino in Melbourne. And in the 90s, they mass-released poker machines out into the community. And so they went into footy clubs and they went into hotels. And Australia has 25% of the world's poker machines with 0.5% of the world's population. I mean, this has not been done anywhere else in the world to release so many poker machines into the community. And look, I mean, in the AFL, you know, which is the code I follow, clubs became dependent on poker machines.
How much do they get from it?
Well, look,
how much does your Essendon get from gambling?
Millions. Right. And I think one figure bandied around is that some clubs are dependent for 30% of their revenue on gambling. Now, my club Essendon, you know, I'm ashamed to say, has poker machines. But if you look at Essendon's, you know, promotion of its culture, it'll say follow the game, not the odds.
Mm.
You know, but out the back, the bank of poker machines. So clubs, you know, have become dependent. They've opportunistically decided to follow this, but some other clubs like Geelong, I think I'm correct in saying, some other AFL clubs in Melbourne have got rid of poker machines because they could see the damage that the machines were doing to their own fan base.
How much do the clubs, or do they get anything from online gambling ads on TV? How much does the AFL get from that?
Well, look, I mean, you know, the big gambling companies, I think the AFL's official sponsor is still Sportsbet, so they do a deal with the AFL and the same with the NRL, where they license, the big footy codes license these big national, international gambling companies to advertise, and the deals they cut with them is that they get a take on each gambling action. So what's the incentive for the codes? Expand the gambling because they're making more money. They're not just making the set amount. They're making the additional amount they get from the number of gambling business that's transacted. And I mean, that's just an incentive for football codes to promote gambling in the community. I think it's shocking.
And this is important to realise, isn't it, that the expansion of a lot of these codes is about it's about a couple of things. It's about providing, in many cases, more product to show on television, and secondly and powerfully, more opportunities, therefore, for people to gamble, and therefore the gambling companies are pushing it hard to have more games, more fixtures, more things on for that same reason. It's nothing to do with the sport or the game or what would be good for the game as such, is it?
No, not at all. You know, the other side to the sponsorship is not only the sponsorship deals with gambling companies I just mentioned. The other part of this is the arms race in broadcasting rights between the big sporting codes and the TV stations. And they're now in the billions of dollars. And that kind of links the profitability of the television companies to gambling ads. I mean, this is the other part of how this has all been stitched up and normalised and a power structure created around it. And, of course, the public, you know, like the experience we started talking about with me and my grandson, you know, the public have been screaming to get rid of these ads for years.
This is a strange thing. They're not popular, are they? They're not popular.
They hate it.
If you do a poll, no poll ever shows.
70%.
Yes.
70%.
People want the gambling ads to be got rid of.
They do.
So why don't governments do something about it?
Because the power structure of the industry is just too great for politicians.
What does that mean, though, Mister? I mean, Andrew Wilkie's been pushing this hard in the Parliament for a while. Anthony Albanese's had proposals in front of him for his second term, and it's just sitting on his hands. He's not doing anything about it.
He's walked away from it. That's the sad reality of it.
So what's going on there? What's the political cost in not doing something about it?
Well, politicians look at this and think the cost of taking on this powerful vested interest when you've got the TV stations involved, you've got, you know, big sporting codes involved, and you've got, you know, Coles and Woolies, you know, were involved in poker machines at one stage.
Because they owned a lot of hotels, didn't they?
They owned a lot of hotels. So you've got the hotel industry. Like, these are all big, powerful structural entities in the community, and they're all integrated in the way in which they want to retain and promote and continue to grow gambling. So governments sit there and look, Jesus, you know, what's the cost of taking this on? Mm. And by the way, the gambling industry, you mentioned Andrew Wilkie. Well, I interviewed Andrew for the book because he tried to do a deal with the Gillard government to bring in one modest gambling reform measure, 2011, when Gillard was in minority government. And the industry came out with an absolutely ferocious campaign to knock it off. And eventually Gillard walked away from it.
Hmm.
Just segueing to Albo, I mean, Albanese was handed a parliamentary report in 2023. It gave him a real political opportunity of a bipartisan report calling for bold political reform, backed up, as we said, by overwhelming public opinion, with the in principle support of the then opposition leader, Peter Dutton, and he still walked away and has said nothing about it since before the 2024 election. And I think that tells you a lot.
Here's the thing, though. I'm talking with Quentin Beresford. He's written an interesting book called Hooked, Inside the Murky World of Australia's Gambling Industry, which doesn't call for the abolition of gambling, but just examines the rapacious nature of which the corporatisation of gambling has taken over many aspects of Australian, what you might call entertainment life, and is dredging massive sums out of people in many cases. Well, they certainly can't afford it, even if they think they can. But whatever, it's like an additional form of taxation in a way, isn't it?
It is very much like it's directly a form of taxation. When you think about it, lots of ordinary Australians on, you know, modest incomes are caught up in the web of gambling, and they're paying these gambling taxes, and billions are going to state governments in gambling taxes. And it's a bit like a transfer of wealth from ordinary Australians to massively wealthy international and national.
Yeah, because who owns the online sports betting companies?
Oh, well, there's several of them. The biggest one is Tabcorp in Australia, but there's Sportsbet, Betfair, Flutter. A lot of them are based in, in the UK and UK and other, you know, other.
But they're
countries.
Not Australian homegrown.
Well, they're not Australian. And the profits are going overseas. I mean, they employ people. It's the old argument. They employ people, but the profits go overseas. So ordinary Australians are delivering up this $32 billion in annual losses, and most of it's going overseas. And, you know, there have been reports written where social welfare groups say, I mean, this is a hidden part of the cost of living crisis, that ordinary Australians hooked into, you know, the gambling culture where they spend far more than they can afford.
Mm.
You know, are under financial stress themselves at an already difficult time.
Here's the thing, though, Quentin. What do you think we ought to do about? Sorry, what do you think governments or anybody else should be doing about it? Because to get back to the start of our conversation, it's a complicated issue because it's legal. It's not necessarily bad of itself. It's certainly fun. It's fun to gamble. And next Tuesday, for example, large percentage of the nation will gamble, and sometimes for the first time in the year on the Melbourne Cup. Lots of people buy tickets in Lotto and, you know, are sustained daydreaming about what they'd do with the money if they, in the extremely unlikely event that they ever won anything on it, including the big prize. So, you know, there's a whole aspect of gambling that you might say is quite legitimate. I think everyone thinks this online sports thing's just got completely out of control and ought to be. But what about the rest of it? What do you think?
Well, look, I think you start from the principle of harm minimisation. You're quite correct about the legalisation of it. You're quite correct to say that many people, perhaps most people, can use it as a form of entertainment and keep it under control. I don't have any quibble with that. It's where it gets into significant community harm that we've got to take a look at it. And I think if you want me to run through a few measures, I can.
Go on.
I think you do need a phase out of the prolific number of poker machines in the community. I mean, they are addictive. They're dangerous. It's estimated that 30% of regular poker machine gamblers will go on to develop a problematic gambling habit. So that's one thing. The second thing I think is we do need to ban gambling advertising. Several things,
Can you do that?
I mean,
it's a legal activity. I suppose they banned cigarette ads.
Well, they banned cigarette ads, and that's what the gambling reformers say. We took the smoking industry on. Now you said that, there's not direct parallel between smoking and gambling in terms of harm. It gets almost to that point where you've got the tsunami of gambling ads now there to increase the gambling market. So I would say a ban on gambling ads, or at least heavy restrictions on when they can be shown. There's some restrictions, but not enough. And then I think the really big structural issue is we've got to wean state governments off gambling taxes, and I think that would necessitate a Commonwealth-state agreement, I think. Because state governments, I mean, gambling is typically a state government responsibility. State governments more or less don't want to do anything about it, or very little. And because they're dependent on the gambling revenue. So it seems to me the Commonwealth's got to come to the party, to the party on that. Yeah.
What about Lotto? Because a lot of gambling advocates say, well, hang on, everyone bags, poker machines and, okay, fair enough. But what about Lotto? No one ever mentions Lotto, and that's probably the biggest one of all.
This probably is one of the biggest ones, yeah, and it gets caught up in all the statistics. I mean, I think you could mount an argument. I mean, there'll be people who don't like Lotto and all the rest of it, so that's fine. But I think if you look at it as a part of a gambling ecosystem, it's pretty much at the lower end of it. You know, you buy one ticket, you might be able to buy them multiple times a week, but it's going to be pretty hard to, lose your shirt, playing Lotto. Having said that, Lotto's recently got into the game of larger expenditures. Last time I was in a newsagent, I looked up on the wall and you can buy Lotto tickets now for hundreds of dollars, as part of a share.
A syndicate, yeah.
Syndicate, yeah. So Lotto itself has got into the game of leveraging up. It was part of the whole culture of this. But no, look, I think you've got to start from the premise that historically, across cultures, people like to gamble. It's the risk.
Yeah, we do.
It's the risk gene inherent in many humans, and you take that and you run with it, and you say, well, how can this industry offer opportunities for people to gamble safely, and how can you minimise the harm that can occur if the industry's industrialised and allowed to grow in a way that's uncontrolled?
Yeah, some might say, look, this is all very well, Quentin, but you're harking back to some sort of, yesteryear when, the only thing you were allowed to gamble on was pontoon in a game of cards with friends or the horses. And we're never going to go back to that.
No, but I think it's a matter of being realistic, I think, and sensible and, quite frankly, humane. I mean, it's not acceptable that, according to official figures, 400 Australians die from gambling-induced suicides each year, 400. And financial counsellors reckon that's an underestimate. So we've just got real harm here occurring because the industry has been allowed to grow too large, and too many parts of the industry — this doesn't speak to all parts of the industry, but too many parts of the industry — are under pinned by a predatory business model. In other words, they're out to recruit as many gamblers as they can, and they're out to keep as many gamblers gambling for longer at higher levels of expenditure than they can. And I mean, it's that end of it that really needs serious reform, and it needs a national approach. It needs the Prime Minister to step up, quite frankly.
Which he's not going to do, as you've said. Graham in Perth. G'day, Graham.
G'day, Phil and Quentin. My question is the modern mobile smartphone just as guilty as any other machine we have in casinos for gambling?
Is it worse than poker machines, in other words?
Yes.
It's a fair question.
It's a very good question. It's a very good question because, yes, once smartphones came on the scene in 2007, and if you look at the graph on gambling expenditure in Australia, it just takes off. So, yeah, I mean, the modern smartphone is effectively a casino in your pocket. And obviously linked into the internet, you can gamble anywhere you like. So that end of it, you know, takes very careful thought to how you can control it, but it's just part of the challenge of it. But yes, it's a significant part of the problem.
Would it be feasible to say you can't gamble on sport anymore? People would say, what about the horses? Well, you could quarantine that. I suppose you have to quarantine greyhounds. That's another matter. But could you make it illegal to gamble on organised sport apart from those two examples, couldn't you?
Well, as I said, that was the case historically until it was deregulated. What I would prefer to happen is that the government's banned sporting codes having relationships with gambling companies and banning the ads, so you're actually not promoting it. Now, whether or not it's realistic in an internet age to prevent the gambling online on sports probably become quite difficult. But what you want to do is take the harm minimisation approach. You don't want to industrialise that. You don't want to put it in people's faces. You don't want to over-promote it, and you don't want to poke kids' noses in front of it.
Right. One of our texters is saying kids ought to have the odds explained to them, and then they would see how ridiculous it is. But I don't know. I don't think that would work, would it? I mean, the thing about Lotto is the odds. I mean, why would you ever buy a ticket in it? Because the odds of winning are ludicrously bad. However, every week someone does.
Yeah.
And this is what keeps it going, isn't it?
Well, let me just get back to the issue of kids. Kids know odds now.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the ads, they very subtly take kids through the process of understanding how ads work.
Yeah.
And all the studies have shown this, that I quote in the book, that kids have high brand name recognition of gambling companies and they have high knowledge of how odds work. I mean, they think they know, of course, but they don't grapple with the ridiculous impossibilities of the odds. But they know conceptually how odds work. And I mean, you know, we're just raising a generation of kids, many of which are going to go on to be problem gamblers. And by the way, many, you know, some of them go on to be elite sportsmen. And it's interesting, once the current crop of elite sportsmen go into their football clubs, they have to be given anti-gambling programs. I mean, they have to be almost deprogrammed because society has said it's legitimate, it's fun, it's harmless. And the codes know they're one step away, as the NRL in America was this week, from a major betting scandal that will cruel the sport.
Yeah, sure enough. Quentin, we've run out of time, and the odds of us proceeding are against it. but it's an interesting and a well-researched book too. It's called Hooked: Inside the Murky World of Australia's Gambling Industry. Quentin Beresford, who's a Professor of Politics on the University of the Sunshine Coast, has been our guest tonight. Quentin, thank you.
Thank you, Phil. Enjoyed the conversation.
Appreciate the time too. And if you are having difficulties about anything mentioned tonight in relation to gambling, then the number for Lifeline is 13 11 14, 13 11 14. There is a national gambling helpline too, 1800 858 858, 1800 858 858. So check them out if you feel that that's appropriate for you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.